There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When people ask you what happened here, tell them the North remembers. Tell them winter came for House Frey.
And welcome back, everybody, to Benched with Bubba, episode 46. Game of Thrones, kind of episode one recap, meets fantasy baseball with none other than good buddy Nathan Dawkin. You can find him on Twitter, at Nathan Dawkin, my friend. That thing alone got me chilled up last night. How are you doing, and how was episode one for you?
Thanks so much for having me back. It's good to be chatting with you again, especially after some sweet-ass Game of Thrones action, man. That episode last night was so badly needed. I had finally finished my complete rewatch of the series, and man, I tell you, that first scene with Arya as Walder Frey, that was priceless, man. It was so kick-ass to see her get revenge in that way. And not only that, I got a hell of a kick out of Walder Frey being just completely out of character. totally just complimenting everybody and being so over-the-top nice, which is not him at all. So if I was in that crowd, man, part of his family, I'd be looking at everybody else like, what, something is amiss here. Like, this is not good.
Yeah, it was like so weird. Yes, I called you back at like midnight after we've already met once tonight because I want to tell you how much I love you. Something Walter Frey never does, ever. Yeah, and she's just killing time waiting for the poison to kick in. I tell you, I loved when she did it at the end of season six, and I might have liked that even more, and I cannot wait to where she's going with this storyline, because my goodness, I knew she wanted to kill Walter. I didn't see her killing the entire Frey family.
Yeah, she went all out, man, and that already, like, immediately was scene one. You know, it's so fun theorizing all this stuff, where the series is going to go, where the characters are going to go, what's going to happen, try to predict all that kind of stuff in between seasons, and immediately, like, the first scene, one of the more interesting ones that I had heard, was blown out of the water, where they're thinking that she was going to use Walder Frey's disguise to sneak up on, you know, like, Cersei and Jaime and just kill them that way, thinking that, you know, that she's just Walder Frey. But yeah, they got word of his demise very quickly, and so that's not gonna happen. So she's gonna have to find a different avenue for revenge now.
Well, I got a theory on that, and we'll get to that a little later as we go through this episode. We're gonna try to get to fantasy baseball, I promise people. We're gonna try. But Nathan and I, we've DM'd back and forth about Thrones, and we talked about doing this episode for quite some time. He did an awesome preview on his podcast. Why don't you go ahead, and before I get going, I feel like a horrible host now. Why don't you plug the 12 places or whatever you're at, including your very new venture. That's really awesome.
Yeah, there are some interesting things going on. So yeah, still writing over at Fantastics Insider Baseball and at Big Guy Fantasy Sports. I do a weekly Fire and Ice article there, performance evaluation. And of course, the Nasty Cast will continue to do its nasty thing. And something that I don't think anybody in the public really knows yet, there's been a bit of a change of plans. The Nasty Cast was going to be joining Fantrax Radio, which just launched today. But instead, what's going to be happening is we're going to be doing a brand spanking new podcast for Fantrax Radio called the Fantrax Dynasty Baseball. and it's going to feature myself and Van Lee and Ron Rigney, the same crew from the Nasty Cast. But we're going to be strictly looking into dynasties, dynasty evaluations and prospects and that kind of stuff over at FanTrax. And I am really excited to do that. So just another podcast on my plate. One more thing to do. Good Lord. I'm stretching myself thin, but man, it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it.
That's awesome. So you're going to do that and keep the Nasty Cast going?
Yep, the Nasty Cast is going to remain exactly as it is. You can find it on any of your podcast apps, on Blog Talk Radio. That's where we host it. So that will not change. And this the Fantrax Dynasty Baseball Podcast is going to be available only on Fantrax Radio. So that one is a little different. And obviously, you can just listen to that on Fantrax. You know, so if you have any leagues there, you're setting your lineups, hey, click a little Fantrax Radio. Get smarter while you play.
No, that's awesome. I've been seeing you guys, the BGFS guys that don't know, the big guys, fantasy sports, really awesome group of guys, fun stuff they put out. They have their podcast. Nathan has his, a part of the network, all kinds of good stuff. Check them out. Really, really good. And I've been seeing them tweeting out about this Fantrax Radio for a while. So it's really cool seeing everything you guys are developing over there. Lots of good stuff. And his weekly Fantastics articles or however often, I can't remember, a couple times a week, really good stuff there as well. So tons of good stuff there. But let's get back to what's important now. No offense to you, is Game of Thrones Episode 1, Season 7. So we mentioned Arya, kicks things off. It's one of the few times, I think it's like less than five times now, maybe the fifth time, Game of Thrones in the entire series has started out without the song we all love. And, you know, we feel like a 12-year-old the first time we saw a Bronn Panties article. It was amazing. But it's just open. Arya does her thing. We talked about it. It's amazing. She's going to go on a tear, and we'll get to that in a minute. What comes next is after the great song, where you see the map of Westeros and everything else that is great in this world of Game of Thrones, we see this just foggy image of the White Walkers heading towards the wall. But there is something very important that I noticed in that. What did you notice in that group of White Walkers?
Giants, bro. They got a bunch of giants now. Holy crap. That is terrifying. Yeah. As if there was anything else that they needed to help them, you know. They've got the biggest army on Earth already, and now they've got a whole horde of freaking giants. So, yeah, things just keep getting better.
Yeah.
But I was really excited that they didn't make us wait to see the White Walkers, though. Like you said, right after the opening theme, there they are, slowly approaching very ominously. I love that scene.
Oh, it was great because my wife and I are watching it, and I'm like, what the heck are they doing? Is that a boat in the fog? Was it? And all of a sudden, we see the horse. You see a little more, like, oh, crap. But a side note to that, like you said, you're glad they showed them. Usually Game of Thrones, at least the first episode, if not the first couple, it's like slow, you know, buildup of, like, storylines and all this. This was one of the best episodes where they did the buildups, but they kept it moving, and it was action-packed the entire time. And just a little scene like that, it wasn't any more than, what, a minute to 2 minutes max, was so important in the entire scheme of things. It was amazing.
Yeah, you said it exactly. I think that, in episode one always requires a little bit of revisiting, hopping around, making sure we all know where everybody's at, just retouching on the storylines while trying to progress the plot a little bit. But basically, it's just regrouping everything. And yeah, I think this was probably the best job they've ever done at that, as far as not having the episode feel slow. So we got a taste of everybody, and it was still an awesome episode, regardless of it just being sort of a setup episode.
So after the White Walkers, we head to Winterfell, and this had many layers to it. And there's one layer we'll get to that I was talking about on my preview, and I'm pretty sure you guys talked about it on your preview between Sansa and Jon. But it starts out, Jon is basically preparing everybody for what's to come, that they need to focus on the north still, not move south, all these things. But John does a couple things that get Sansa a little riled up. I don't know if you want to get into that first.
Yeah, man. I think that Sansa might still be a little bitter about him not consulting her at the Battle of the Bastards last year, you know, when she had some valuable insight, and he totally just kind of, he's like, you're a girl, you don't know what the hell you're talking about, you know, whereas she knew Ramsay and she could have helped John greatly, and now he's sort of trying to dismiss her, you know, which maybe she shouldn't have spoken up at the great table in front of everybody like that. But at this point, she is not really one to hold back. I think she's she at this point of the series, she's been through so much. She's a cut the crap kind of girl. And she alluded to it a little bit later as far as her being influenced. She's been influenced pretty heavily by Cersei at this point. Yeah. And we know how Cersei is. So,
yeah, that was so good, because that's a scene we'll talk about a couple scenes from now. But yeah, when John basically says, you know, the way you talk about her, it's almost like you look up to her. And it's so true, though. Everything she's gone through, she's like, I've learned a lot from her. And you can see a lot of those things kind of in the early Cersei that you saw. You know, she's still trying to be this, you know, kind of pretty young thing going out there. But she's also has that no nonsense. This is what we're doing. And I'm going to screw you over if you're going to get in my way. Like the way you said, she shouldn't have talked up at the table. That's one thing you talk to John about later. You need to keep the leadership the way it is. But a theory I've always had coming into this, and it showed its ugly head early, is Littlefinger's already in her ear saying, you're the rightful heir to Stark. He's not a Stark. So you should be queen of the North. This king of the North shouldn't be happening. And they keep showing the clip over and over of him standing there smirking the whole time. Yeah. You can see it wearing on her more and more and more. It was deep. Really,
there's, I tell you what, like pretty much any scene in the Littlefinger has been in throughout the entire series, it could just be like a cardboard cutout of him with that smirk, and they just like prop it up where he's standing, and he can just do like a voiceover. He's always got the same exact look on his face, just with different words popping out of his mouth, and you know he's always just looking out for himself. And Sansa sees right through that at this point. She's wise in a way. So I honestly, I'm kind of frightened to see what Littlefinger has up his long sleeves, because he's always scheming and planning. And it seems like if there's anyone who can sort of throw a wrench into everything that is kind of out of left field, it's him.
No, definitely. Back to the great hall, the great table. Our little lady Mormont strikes again. That girl is amazing. You know, I forget the guy that stood up what house he was for, basically said after John said, we need all women, children, everyone has to learn how to fight. We need every person we have. And the guy says, I'm not training my daughter, all these things. And Lady Mormont stands up and just gives another speech of all speeches about basically you're a little girl. I'm the big girl. And this is what we're going to do. And John start training immediately.
Yep. She tells it like it is. Yeah, she's definitely the boss of that room behind Jon Snow, man. He could not have asked for a better person to have standing behind him, basically.
Yeah, she's amazing. And then I think a couple more things happened in this. There's a big scene. The scuffle, basically, between Sansa and Jon is Jon, you know, we have the Karr Starks and somebody else, I can't remember, they joined Ramsay's crew. And so Sansa wants their, you know, families, you know, taken away, given the castles, the new families. And Jon, no, one family's mistake can't ruin it for decades. La, 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 la. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it does have, I mean, you can see both sides, right? And that's sort of a microcosm of the series. And that's what makes it so great, is because you get two very good angles on the same subject. And one isn't necessarily right. But I think that, what John has been through throughout the series definitely influences this decision. And he has found out that maybe, I mean, it's one thing to be like his dad, Ned, well, sort of dad, you know, and have honor, and but that came back to bite him in the ass in a big way. And you know, maybe it's better to show a little just not go around cutting everybody's heads off, especially at a time like this where you need everybody to be united. You can't have a bunch of infighting. So I think that in the end he went with the right decision.
Yeah, I agree. The last part you said there is the most important, is they need everybody possible. So getting rid of people, getting rid of, you know, strategic locations of castles, not good ideas, because originally she just wanted to demolish things. Yeah. It was that bad. Last thing, a change is going to be happening at the wall if John gets everything he wants, which he should. John is going to basically take, you know, all the help there to help fight, and he's going to leave the wildlings in charge of the wall. Do you think this has a long lasting impact on the wall and anything else involved?
Oh man. See, I really don't know what exactly is going to happen there. It kind of feels like whenever the White Walkers show up and they're at the wall and it's a bunch of wildlings, it seems like they're a little bit easier fodder as far as being killed for the purposes of the show. There's not a lot of wildlings that we're going to miss. You know, it's like Tormund and that's pretty much it. So I think that there is going to be a big battle at the wall. I think that maybe that's how this particular season comes to an end, as the wall finally comes down. I don't know how that's going to happen exactly, but I think regardless, all the wildlings, all the people at the wall, they're going to see a lot of action by the time the season's over. And I think maybe more than anything, I'm most excited for that aspect of the show, that storyline.
No, I completely agree. That's what's going to take us to the wall. Is I've been thinking all along that the wall has to come down at some point. It's just proper. The White Walkers can't go through with the wall there. That's just the way it works. Unless the key thing that I'm leading to now is after we leave Winterfell, Bran and Reed end up at the back gate to the wall. And they finally get let in after a few things. And my only thing is, do you think, since Bran's been touched, that's how they got into the tree, does this allow them access through the wall?
Yeah, I've heard that before, and that is interesting. If he unwittingly, just by showing up at the wall, is negating the magical properties that the wall has. But at the same time, I feel like that's sort of a stupid cop-out, which I don't know if George is one to really do something like that. So I hope that that's not the case. But it's, I mean, he's... I'm really excited to see exactly what he's going to bring to the wall and all his flashbacks and, you know, exactly how the wall is going to come down and all that kind of stuff. Seems like a foregone conclusion. So I don't exactly know. Like I said, I hope they don't take that exact avenue, but we'll see.
Yeah. And it's something you said on your preview, on your Nasty Cast preview. I think Bran's storyline is going to be so awesome this year. Just 'cause, like you said, all the flashbacks are going to get deeper into some of the key storylines that kind of develop to what things are now. I think there's a lot. He's going to have a huge role, I think, in the end of this. I think him and Sam Tarly are going to be your unsung heroes of this, the last few episodes. But just like that White Walker part, that was just a quick clip to let you know what's up, and we move on. And we head to Power Trip Cersei in Westeros, or in King's Landing, as she's getting, you know, Westeros painted on the floor, and she just wants to play God. And Jaime walks in and basically, what are you doing? And Cersei coming back with her is, are you mad? It's just the back and forth. You can see the riff is continually developing, and it could lead to something very, very interesting. What do you take from that whole back and forth between them?
Yeah, they're not quite on the same page anymore as they once were. Cersei, like you said, just hell-bent on power, and let's just conquer everything. And he's like, why? We don't have any kids anymore. All the kids are dead. We don't have any allies at all. You know, sort of like, what's the point anymore? But she is sort of letting that all go in one ear and out the other. And she's going to, Cersei going to Cersei, you know, she's not going to let anything get in her way. She wants destruction. She wants all her enemies vanquished. And it's an interesting storyline too, because Jamie's right, really. Like, they have no allies. So except for Euron, I suppose we'll get to that in a little bit. But it's sort of yet to be seen if he is actually an ally or not.
Yeah, he said a great quote to her, and it kind of leads to something I left out, or that actually comes up. I'll beat the point here. She sends a raven out to all the kingdoms, and Jon gets it and says, you know, this is Cersei, queen of the seven kingdoms, all this stuff, come bow down before me or you're a traitor. Well, she's telling Jaime that, yes, I'm in charge of the seven kingdoms, and he basically stops her in her tracks and goes, you're lucky if it's three. He named off all the ones, like, you have enemies all around you, like you said, and it was perfect just to look on her face like, oh crap. and then it breaks away, like, they talk about a few other things that aren't as relevant, they are but they're not, and it breaks away to she's saying she has, you know, a guy, the Greyjoys, and he you're on, and he wants a queen. And Jaime's has this look on his face like, what, like, we're supposed to be, you know, together basically. Yeah, you've already screwed up everything else. So yeah, that leads us to Huron. They come on in, and he gives his cockier than cocky appeal to her. What do you think is going to come out of, like, what's he going to do to prove the loyalty?
Oh man! I mean, first of all, this scene is fantastic. Like, he is giving it to Jamie hard. He's like, "I got two hands. I can make a hell of a better lover." And like, oh my god, she goes, "Oh, you killed your own brother. How could we trust you?" He's like, "It felt good. You should try it sometime." Like, man,
that was outstanding.
This dude is all balls. You gotta love it. So I don't know exactly. The first thing that came to my mind when he said he was going to go give her a gift, immediately Tyrion popped into my head. I have no idea why. That's just like, if you're doing, oh crap, just whatever. I can't think of the word. The first thing that pops in your head, basically, when you say that improv, you know, that's the first thing that came to my head. But then, I think it was Ben that speculated on our show too, something about a dragon horn. Which would help them control the dragons instead of Daenerys potentially. And so that is something that is terrifying as a possibility as well. But beyond that, I have no idea.
Yeah, I heard that on your podcast. And that's about the only thing that came into my mind was that, because outside of the dragons, I don't know what the heck she could do to prove her loyalty or whatever to him. But yeah, when he was giving it to Jamie, because Jamie had come back with little comments about all you guys do is this or that. And then the line about killing your brother, you should try it, was priceless. Absolutely priceless.
And the look on his face, man. So good.
Because he walks in there, and when he tries to walk closer to the throne, the mountain steps up, and he's like, okay, I got you. I'm going to step back for a minute.
Yeah, he's got balls, but he's got brains enough to know when he's outmatched. He stepped back pretty quick.
Yeah, so that was pretty good. I'm curious to see where that goes, because I've heard read and heard some interviews with him basically saying he's going to be more hated than Ramsay and Joffrey ever were. So this can be really deep come season's end. After that, we go to good old Sam Tarly trying to become a maester. Apparently, you got to deal with a lot of shit becoming a maester. He's cleaning, he's putting books back on the shelf, he's going to every bedside, and apparently all they have is runny shits there. It's unbelievable. That was like the worst thing I've ever. Even my wife was like, "What are they eating there?"
Yeah,
they're eating soup, and it comes straight out like soup.
They've got a straight curry diet down there at Old Town.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. But the important part is typical Sam. You know, it was kind of off and on, but he finally gets into the. I don't even know the guy's name he was with. They were, you know, dissecting a dead body to find out different things about him. And he wants in the secret room where the books are, the important books. And he starts asking him, why do people think, you know, White Walkers, I'm lying about it, this, that, and the other. And it's pretty interesting, because we've noticed that in other areas where people are like, no, they don't exist. And he finally gets in, and he does something early in episode one I never thought he would have done, is already figure out where the dragonglass is. What do you think of, you know, Sam's whole deal there? And then what else do you think he can help with throughout the process?
Yeah, I was really glad that, I mean, I enjoyed that montage as much as anybody. I was laughing my balls off. Poor Sam. I'm thinking like, man, maybe the wall wasn't as bad as this. Like, maybe he wants to go back. I mean, I guess he's at least warm here, but geez, that was pretty brutal. But yeah, I was glad that they paid it off at the end by him actually finding out something as important as that mountain of dragon glass out of Dragonstone. And so they paid that off really quickly, and I'm sure that we're gonna find something else you know, with him, that he's, I mean, that's what he's there for, right? He's figuring out how to beat the White Walkers, and already he's off to a pretty good start. And I gotta say, one thing that I found, a link on Facebook today from somebody who, you know, when he was paging through those books and he saw the map for Dragonstone, somebody took the time to freeze frame that page, and it said something about a cure for grayscale on the same page as the dragon glass. So perhaps, you know, we saw a mysterious man locked in a cell. Perhaps he could be helped out somehow by Sam in a future episode.
A mysterious man that continued to profess his love for one Daenerys Targaryen that just had grayscale on his arm. Some mysterious man. But speaking of that mysterious man, we'll skip to this. I am glad that he went there, because she basically told him, you know, go find a cure. And where else would you go besides a place like that? Because there's no one else who's going to figure it out. So that's crazy that it's on the same page. That part's pretty funny to me. But I was thinking that he'd help with that process as well, because the mysterious man is going to play another role in this season. You know he's not going to just go away. So that was cool to see. Sam's basically that interaction alone in that scene, A, shows you where he's at. B, shows you he's going to build a connection with Sam, because every day someone comes by and grabs those pans. Why does he wait till Sam comes by to reach out and touch him? So I think that's a deeper, unless I'm just overlooking, like overthinking it, I think it's a deeper thought process.
I think what it was, he was trying to reach out and touch Sam because he saw how grossly overweight Sam is, and he's trying to turn him, and gives him rock hard abs.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Rock hard abs. Oh, that's good stuff. No, that's great. The one other thing, you said you're reading the books now. How far have you gotten on those?
Yeah, unfortunately, my pace has slowed down with all this new stuff that's going on in my world. But I made it through. I'm about halfway through the first book. I got I got the whole set for Father's Day. So,
okay, I was wondering. My wife's read them, so I'll have to ask her. But I'm pretty sure when full grayscale sets in, you basically become like mental, like you just don't think straight. So,
yeah,
that also shows that things are still okay at the moment. All right, back to Winterfell. I know this is going to be long, people, but it was awesome. It really was. We get Sansa and Baelish talking it out, and they will look at Brienne down below training her little buddy, her squire, and we got our wildling giving her little winks because, you know, someday that has to happen. Speaking of which,
yeah.
Well, we'll get to that later. Sorry. But that was awesome. But when Sansa basically tells Baelish, I'm fine, leave me alone, the best thing she said is no need to seize the last word, Lord Baelish. I'll assume it was something clever.
Yeah, she is so sick of his crap.
Yeah, yeah, and she basically tells like John and Brienne, like, well, I have to put up with it because without him, we would have died. So, but
it's true.
Yeah, but what do you think? Because Brienne's like, she could sense, like, I need to come up there and get rid of him, basically. So there's an interesting dynamic being built there, being built with the wilding, being built with Peter, because Peter's not leaving. He wants something. We kind of all have an idea. She even said, I know what he wants. What do you think it is Baelish wants?
He said as much. He wants her. He wants the throne, man. He wants it all. And she ain't having it. She is throwing it back in his face, not so subtly. So you got to guarantee, you know, with him, he's already got the wheels turning up in the head, and he's figuring something out, and it's not going to be good. I don't think he will hesitate to turn on the Starks. You know, he's not really shown loyalty to anybody but himself in the past, and for God's sakes, he sold her basically to Ramsay Bolton, and he knew full well what he was. So, yeah, he's just about as frightening to me as the White Walkers or Cersei.
Yeah, I mentioned that on my preview with my buddy that Cersei said it a long time ago, basically, like, if you're not playing the Game of Thrones, you're going to die or something like along those lines. And I said Cersei and Varys and Baelish are the three best players in the entire realm. They're literally zero Fs given to the situation, and it's awesome. Let's leave Winterfell and get to one of the weirdest / cruel scenes of the show, and I think this is where my Arya angle is going to come in. Arya's just cruising on her horse, making her way to King's Landing, comes upon a bunch of Cersei's soldiers traveling to see the Freys, as we find out eventually, because they heard there's problems in Freyland. And they invite her to come eat, and they talk, and she drinks some wine, and they ask, hey, why are you going that way? And she says, to kill the queen. And they laugh at her because they underestimate her like everyone else does.
Yeah.
What is your whole like feelings and takeaway from that scene? Because it was really, really cool. A lot was going on there, and I'm not exactly sure how much is going to develop into something else, or if it was just I don't know. There's a lot going on in that scene.
Yeah, I think, aside from Ed Sheeran being stealing the scene there, I guess, it's kind of weird. I had heard a lot about him being in the season. I don't think he's going to be a recurring character or anything like that, but it was interesting that they got it out of the way, like right away, first episode of the season. But yeah, I kind of think that it was just sort of an interesting side scene. I don't necessarily know that it's going to have a lot of bearing on the storyline, but I think what it was showing us is that where she is going all out as far as getting vengeance on those that have done her wrong, She still has a heart, and like those guys were talking about how they got families back home, and you know, they're not bad guys. Basically, pretty much all of the Lannister soldiers and everybody else that we've seen out on these roads are all giant douchebags, and they'll kill anybody for, you know, a crusty sock. And these guys were totally cool. They gave her free food, and she was just laughing it up with them. And so I think that basically gave us some insight that she's not just this evil, like, revenge bent little girl anymore. You know, there's still Arya in there, and she's still a Stark, and she's still mostly good. She just, you know, wants to kill those that have done her wrong.
I agree with all of that, except my theory, which we all get theories in Game of Thrones that are mostly wrong. I think she's softening up to him so she can kill one of them and use all his face to get into King's Landing.
Ah, okay. That could be.
That's a long shot. I'm just an angle. We leave the little fire party, you know, dinner party, and we get to your favorite character, or one of your favorite characters. We get the Hound and his good old buddies marching around through the snow. And they come upon the house where the Hound and Arya once were, and where they killed a father-daughter combo. And no, that's not a XXX movie. So this was an interesting scene because the Hound, being the Hound himself, had a lot of his famous lines. But he shows a heart, and he starts to learn more about what they are, and he basically turns into someone else. What was your feelings with that whole scene?
Oh, man, this was one of my favorite scenes of the episode, mostly because I love the Hound, and he had, like you said, some great one-liners, as he always does. He's eminently quotable. It actually took me a while for it to click in that was the same place that they were at way back in whatever it was, like season 3 or whatever, when he was with Arya. That didn't click in with me right away. And then when it did, you know, breaks your heart because you see these at a untimely demise that was not deserved. And we do see him show a heart that he never did. You know, he never would have done that back in the beginning of the season, but he sort of has had an epiphany ever since he was left for dead by Arya. And, you know, the Faith of the Seven, they brought him back to life, and he befriended, what's his face? I can never remember his name. He was only there for half an episode, but last season, it kind of steered him in the right path, and like he's kind of a good guy now. And it was really interesting too that he actually, you know, saw things in the fire that the Lord of Light was showing him, and he couldn't believe it, and Beric Dondarrion couldn't believe it either. He started talking about how he sees the White Walkers approaching the wall, and Beric looks back and I'm like, holy, you actually are seeing this? So I'm really stoked to see where that leads.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that part. That part, literally, the look on Beric's face, he turns over his shoulder and like, what? Like, are you BSing me right now? This is unbelievable. And yeah, he's buying into it, and it's going to be really interesting where that storyline goes. I still think he battles his brother at some point in time and kills him. That has to be how it ends. But as we've seen with like Derek and his guys, you know, they have the sword that lights into fire and they fight White Walkers and stuff. There's a lot of interesting plays with the Hound, and it was a very deep scene to show that. And we kind of saw it when he's with Arya, is that he does have a heart, because he could have killed her a long time ago after they found out her mom was dead and stuff. I don't need you anymore. Like, he could have finished that off a long time ago. But he showed differences in him that it's going to be really interesting as that storyline continues to develop.
Yeah, and I don't think he ever would have been a bad guy if it weren't for his brother, you know, melting his face over practically nothing, you know, and then it basically, you know, and then his family covered it up, so it turned everybody against him, and so all of a sudden he's vengeful, you know, against everybody in the world, and he's now this hideous, ugly guy, and everybody hates him. He's just this big, gross thing. So I think that's the only reason that he was ever so, you know, so bad in the first place, and now he's kind of gotten past that, and he's on the right path, as they would say.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. All right, we're getting towards the home stretch here. We kind of already talked on it, but Sam goes home with his books. Gilly's telling him, you need to go to bed, as she plays with little Sam. And he doesn't want to, and he finally finds what he needs. And she's helping him look through books too, which is kind of cool. But he finds it, and you mentioned it. Dragonstone has dragon glass, and he starts to write a note to the Raven. I'm wondering how long it'll take to get there, but we have hope. We have hope because our next scene tells us someone's already there.
Finally, we've been waiting 6 seasons.
Yep.
And she is there. It was a pretty cool moment when she just knelt down and grabbed some of the sand. Finally, Westeros, which she calls home, yet she's never been there.
Well, she was born at Dragonstone. That's where she was born. But yeah, other than that, she's been long gone. So it was really cool. They march around, going through everything. They pull the banner down. That was a cool moment. And then I thought something was really, really cool. She has her throne sitting there, and instead of going and sitting on it, she just looks at it and keeps walking. Two theories is because she's down to business. She's always wanted the Iron Throne. This is not the Iron Throne. She wants one throne and one throne only. And secondly, she walked straight to the room where you remember Stannis was, where, you know, the smoke child was conceived.
Yeah. And, who could forget that touching moment?
It was so romantic. And her and Tyrion just walk around the table, and she's just looking at it, looking at everything. And she has one of the best lines ever to finish an episode. Shall we begin?
Yep.
It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. Okay. Last thoughts on Game of Thrones episode one. That was quicker than I thought, as quick as I could have done it. What's your takeaways? Where are we going?
They touch on pretty much all the storylines. I guess we didn't see Melisandre. She's supposedly wandering about Westeros somewhere. It was my theory in the offseason that she was actually going to meet up with Jorah and use the Lord of Light to cure his grayscale, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. There's something a little bit more scientific, I think, that's going to happen there. So I'm kind of interested to see where she's going to turn up and this Euron worries me and the Littlefinger worries me, but I'm one of those guys. Like I like to sit and theorize, you know, and think about where I could go. But at the same time, I don't want to think about it too much because first of all, you can't predict what's going to happen. Like nobody can. That's what makes this show so great. But I don't want to have anything spoiled either. So I don't want to come across. I'm not going to sit and dig through Reddit and look at all these theories and then have basically one of them be right and ruin everything. So I'm just looking forward to the ride, man. There's only 6 more episodes, which sucks, but I could not be more excited for it.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. That part about it's great. And then I think it was on your preview, one of your guys mentioned that next season's going to be like two mini movies every episode.
Yeah, they sat down to now that, you know, season 7 is all wrapped up, they're finishing the writing for season 8 and they're going to get started filming it. And yeah, they realized that they had so much material that 6 normal episodes was not going to cut it like they had planned. So they're all going to be like an hour and a half, 2 hours long, which is freaking sweet.
Oh, I'm so excited. I thought my Sundays were already good enough. That's going to be, man, I'm going to go buy a case of wine.
I know.
That's going to be outstanding. My God. All right.
What about you? What are you looking forward to the most from the season?
I'm really, really, really like, I wanted the Sam storyline, but the fact they figured out in episode 1 is outstanding. I want to see where that continues to go because I'm a Sam fan. I know he's just been picked on so much, but he's had such big roles that people like overlook. Like Sunday, they redid all of episode or season 6, and the scene where Gilly and him are sitting down at his family's table, and she stands up for him and says, he's done this, he's done this. It's just so crazy, the stuff he's done that people just put him down for. So I'm excited about him. I am very, very excited for the whole wall scenario between the White Walkers, between Bran. I'm with you 1,000% on that. That's going to be epic. That's something. If that – Game of Thrones, I would say never. That's not a good – rarely will ever disappoint you. If somehow that disappoints me, I'm going to be so pissed.
there's no way it's going to happen.
I know there isn't, but God.
Yeah. When you think of all the possibilities, too, that they can do with Bran now that he's the Three-Eyed Raven and everything that he's going to know, and he's got a lot of stories to tell Jon, too, so I don't know when they're going to meet up, but he's got some serious info to tell Jon, and I'm definitely looking forward to him learning his true parentage and how he reacts to that and how that shifts the Game of Thrones. So, and there's going to be some other mind, like, there's going to be a mind blow so big, I don't know if it's going to be this season or next season, but it's going to make the whole Hordor reveal seem like an anthill, you know? Something is going to be just amazing.
Yeah, I agree, because the brand storyline is going to be awesome. I can't wait. I can't wait till John finally figures it out. I don't know. You'd assume it's from Brand, but I have a really good feeling Peter knows.
Yep, that was my other guess. I'm guessing that if anybody else knows, it's him, and he might not let him know in the best possible way.
Yeah, Sansa might find out first type thing. Or he might get tied up with a sword to his throat or something. There's that, or Tyrion might know, I have a feeling. Because he seems to know a lot of things that people don't. Like, he's another sneaky, awesome guy. But that storyline, and then, yeah, Bran's going to find out so many things, tell us so many things. There's a million storylines. I could go on and on about this. I'm pretty much excited about everything.
Yeah. It was also ballsy for them to not have a single line for Tyrion in this entire opening episode.
Yes.
One that they can use him as a crutch, basically, for a lot of scenes, and they did not use him at all.
Yeah, and that's a great point. That showed just how powerful this episode was for an opening one that, like we said, it rekindled a bunch of the old storylines, but at the same time, it was so, so good. And, yeah, he's been a guy on so many episodes where his, like, drunken moment here or there, that's all you remember. That was the episode. It was Tyrion doing this.
Yeah.
And it was so powerful because, like, the last thing you remember of him in season six, he becomes the hand of the queen, and he's so emotional, he's just like speechless. That was awesome. This is going to sound really bad. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about that scene. That was awesome. And then you see him just on a boat staring off into the ocean. That's all you see. He's silent basically the last half of of the last episode. And then they walk into the room, and, you know, in the old Tyrion, he would have been like, okay, we need to do this, this, this. No, he just stares at the wall. He looks at things, and then he just looks at her with like this look on his face. He looks like a dog to his master. Like, like, what do you want to do?
We're here. Let's go. Awesome. And it's, yeah. I mean, he's got to fly a dragon at some point.
Yeah,
that would be one of the three. So cool. Like, reading through the books now had reminded me how early on in the series they plant that in your head that he's talking about, he's reading a book himself about dragons, and Jon Snow talks, he's like, what the hell are you reading that for? Dragons have been extinct for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, and he's talking about as a kid, he's always dreamt of flying one, and like, that would just be such a cool bow on his storyline to see him on top of a dragon.
Now, you mentioned all that stuff, and that stuff that I use as my crutch. How crazy would it be if he was a Targaryen?
I can't even think of what the dragon. It'd be crazy.
Just because, you know, they tell stories about how I guess Rhaegar, and they always had trouble having kids. They were either like disfigured or imps, or they just couldn't have them. And, you know, his dad always mentions how you're not my child, even though most of it just seems like it's spiteful. But why would they make a point to say that over and over and over again?
Well, that would sure be a hell of a reveal, because it did seem like his whole life, you know, Tywin was yelling at him for basically killing his mother, you know.
Yeah. So. And we know Rhaegar and those guys like to sleep around. It's already been evidence. So Mr. Jon Snow's spitting image number one. So I'm just saying, I don't think it'll happen, but it makes even more justification for him flying on a dragon.
Yeah. Oh, and Gendry too. We got to see that boat rowing bastard at some point.
Like, I think it was your podcast or another one that made me laugh. That guy's forearms must be like freaking Mark McGuire. Right
now. He's been rowing for a long, long time.
God, he's gonna look like a 12-year-old the first time he found you porn. It's gonna be unbelievable. Oh, Jesus. All right. Yeah, I could talk to you about this forever. This is awesome. Let's get to some fantasy baseball. Let's make Game of Thrones meet fantasy baseball.
Let's do it.
If you had to pick a Game of Thrones character that resembled the way you run your fantasy baseball team, who would it be and why?
There's a lot of interesting ways to go with this one, but I think I am going to go with someone who we just talked about quite a bit, Peter Baelish, a.k.a. Littlefinger. Because like I'm always scheming myself how to make a beneficial trade and work my way up the standings until I sit atop the proverbial throne, and completely in it for myself. I don't care too much about making a trade that's going to cripple another team. So I think I wanted to pick someone a little bit more manly, but I felt that Littlefinger fit my style the best.
That's outstanding. I spent a lot of time thinking this. I even pulled up like the Game of Thrones cast page, and it's like literally every scenario. That one's phenomenal. The one I went with was maybe not me like forever, but this year, because this year's been so frustrating. I'm going to compare myself to Tyrion, that I'm very knowledgeable about things. I know baseball very, very well, but so much is out of my control, like him and his life, and it just leads me to drink. So I drink and I know things, but my team just can't do what I want it to do. And that's why I feel like Tyrion Lannister this season. It's been so incredibly frustrating that's my guy. But your Baelish one was phenomenal. That's
awesome. No, that's Tyrion is very fitting too. I definitely have been led to drink on more than a few occasions due to fantasy baseball and football. Football breaks my heart even worse, I think.
Well, football, it's because it's all in like one day, basically, where it's just like, or even the first half of your day, you can just see it crumbling in front of you. Yeah. And you're usually drinking, watching football anyways. So just, oh, screw the beer. Let's go to the hard stuff.
Yep. This is the day I'm going to want to forget. Let's go.
Yep. Next week. All right. Winter is here. And so is the second. These are going to be corny people. I apologize. But winter is here. And so is the second half of baseball, which means we get prospects. And I know this is fitting. Now you're running a dynasty show. Let's talk about it. What are some of the prospects? You know, a lot of it everyone's talked about, but who do you think is coming up soon? And more importantly, who's like going to be fantasy relevant?
Well, I hate to break the hearts out there, but I don't know that there's going to be a whole lot of impact second half call-ups like we've had. I don't really see a Gary Sanchez happening again this year, although nobody saw him really doing what he did last year either. But I mean, to compile a short list here, I mean, Yoan Moncada, the number one prospect by the consensus, he's not even really a lock to come up. I don't really know why the White Sox would even bring him up and start his clock when they can just point to his high strikeout rate and his, inadequate batting average, I guess. Like, he's not just slaying at AAA. He has improved. He has cut the K's, but it's still really high. He's still got a ton to prove, and I don't really know that it behooves them to bring him up before September. So, I mean, he will definitely be an impact in the stolen base category if he does get called up, but I'm really not confident that he will. Ahmed Rosario should have been up months ago. He's still toiling away in the minors for no apparent reason. That's driving me freaking nuts because I've had him stashed in my NL only league, and injuries have ravaged that team just like everybody else on the planet Earth. So Ahmed Rosario should have been up. I have him stashed, so I would say out of all these guys, probably stash him. We saw Michael Pineda go down now, so there's a little bit more room in the Yankees rotation, perhaps, for Chance Adams. He's been killing it down on the farm, so he's a guy who on the pitching side could come up and maybe make an impact for them. And then Luke Weaver with the St. Louis Cardinals, he's been dominating at AAA this year, and we saw the Cardinals sort of inexplicably call him up and pitch a couple innings in relief and then send him back down right away. Told him to wait until there's an actual spot in the rotation opens up, and then he'll be back up. So you're pretty much waiting on a trade or an injury for him, but I think he could be a really good starter along with Chance Adams if he is back up in the second half. And then the other guy that I think he also needs an injury or a trade to be up, but it's Rhys Hoskins with the Philadelphia Phillies. If Tommy Joseph, he's not lighting the world on fire exactly, but he's been enough of a roadblock to keep Hoskins down on the farm. And so I think, again, they don't really have a reason to start Hoskins' clock and create them, you know, a logjam on themselves at first base. So Tommy Joseph could be on the move via trade. I've heard a few rumors about him. And if he gets nicked up as well, you could see Hoskins come up. But he's definitely a guy, he's going to walk a ton. He's going to strike out a ton. He's going to hit a ton of bombs. And we've seen a bunch of those guys come up. But he could be another guy that will contribute in those categories if he manages to come up.
Yeah, you pretty much hit everyone I was thinking of, because I'm a big prospects fan. It's just there's not many that are really going to do much right now. They're all kind of a little farther away at best, I think, start of next season. Moncada, super talented, but he's striking out a ton, like you said. It's either they would have brought him up a while ago, or there's really no need right now. Yolmer Sanchez has been formidable. Tim Anderson's formidable, and they paid him a lot. So, well, not a lot, but a lot for him. So they got nowhere to really put him urgently wise, at least.
Yeah, I think
maybe if they trade Todd Frazier, they put him at third, maybe. But that's just, why move a guy around?
Well, that's the thing too. I think Tyler Saladino is back now as well. So even if Frazier moves, and I mean, by the time you get this posted, who knows? He might be moved. He's been talked about that much. But even if he's gone, that doesn't necessarily facilitate a call up of Moncada.
Yeah, it's true. Ahmed Rosario is the one that stands out like no one's business. The fact that, well, no, what it is that the Mets just continue to show the worst run franchise in baseball. That one's mind blowing. Chance Adams, I wouldn't be shocked if we see him pretty soon. They didn't bring him up this last go round. Like today, they brought a couple guys up, but I think it shows they want a stable spot in his rotation. And apparently, that's not Pineda's. Apparently, they're waiting for trades. Maybe he's a part of a trade for the bats they need. Who knows? Because there's rumors that, you know, if they trade for Sonny Gray, they'll get Sonny Gray and Yonder Alonso. Well, if you do that, you'd imagine Chance might be in that deal. So
for sure. Oh, yeah. And if you have him in Dynasty, as long as it's not a wins league, to have him pitching instead of in the Bronx, he's out in Oakland. That's a nice bump.
I saw a couple different packages. They kind of like imaginary, you know, how trade talks work. And Adams in a A's had a scout in single A. And that's where Rutherford, who's a monster, he's like a top 10 prospect, and a couple other big guys in single A that might be packaged with Adams coming over. It could be interesting. And then the Reese Hoskins, that's a great call. That guy is outstanding. But also, I could see for some reason the Phillies are rebuilding, but they're talking trades. They're really, really heavily talking Christian Yelich, which I get. But at the same time, you already have a bunch of outfielders. You're rebuilding. Why are you going to trade away more of your pretty good prospects for Yelich? Maybe I'm missing something here. Maybe you have better logic to this, but it's called Williams, who's great. They got Alfaro, who's playing well. I don't see the need for another outfielder to get rid of talent.
No, I've sort of scoffed at those trade rumors as well. I don't see how it makes sense. You've got guys that are already well past, you know, their arbitration. They've got big money, especially like Giancarlo Stanton. Boy, has he been rumored to be moving around now. Not a lot of teams that can, you know, take on that kind of money. But, it doesn't really make sense to me for the Phillies to do something like that.
Yeah, the latest, he's rumored to come to the Giants, and I like it, but I don't see how it's happening. I just don't see how it's happening.
That wouldn't make much. Well, I mean, I guess he's under contract for a while, so
yeah.
Even though they're super crappy this year, sorry.
Fine.
There's future. Better days ahead.
But yeah, it's just 1 year. All right. Brand Stark should play a major role down the stretch, as we talked about. What are some players that, you know, maybe started off slow, starting to figure it out, and have outperformed their preseason expectations that you're not trying to sell high on, that you think are just awesome? Basically, what guys that were drafted, you know, pretty late to lower than they should have been have just been outstanding this year?
Well, there's the obvious ones, Judge and Bellinger, right? They've just absolutely been phenomenal. So, but sort of skipping over them, there's Marcelo Zuna has been really good this year. He's basically doing this year what he was supposed to do last year before he got injured and basically just wasn't himself over the course of the second half of the season. Hitting for power and average, and I don't think that's a mirage. He's coming into his own at 26 years old. So I definitely would hang on to him. And then really this year it's the fly ball revolution or the air ball revolution. So really all those guys who have sort of adjusted their swing plane or their approach at the plate, DeAndre Alonso's and Justin Smokes and Logan Morrison's, Justin Bour, all those type of guys, I'm hanging on to them. Those changes are legitimate, and you're seeing a whole lot more power out of them than you expected. Another guy who I keep trying to pimp and sometimes misspell, Lucas Duda. He's not necessarily one of these big adjustment guys, but he's still criminally under-owned, and I would be targeting him over the course of the second half, and he's so cheap that, like, if he gets injured like he is wont to do, then you can just cut him, and you're no worse for the wear. But And then too, some pitchers too that I've totally bought into. Alex Wood, man, has he been a season savior for me in the prestigious Dynasty Baseball League. I took him really, really late, and that's you had no investment in him at all. And he's made some tweaks to his delivery, and hopefully he can stay healthy over the course of the second half because he has just been absolutely elite. And so as long as he can stay on the mound, I think he can continue to be really, really good. And then Luis Severino as well. I was totally wrong on him, and I thought that he was going to be a reliever, and he is not only not a reliever, he is a very good starting pitcher. He's managed to up his fastball velocity while also dropping his off-speed velocity, so creating more of a delta there. His changeup has improved. It's by results, it's just fantastic, and he's throwing it more. So all those guys, I definitely feel good hanging on to them. They wouldn't be sell highs for me at all.
Yeah, those are all great. Severino's been amazing. I love your Duda take there. I've been mentioning him since he's come back from the DL in a DFS world. He's been stupid cheap. Yep. The other day he was like $3,100, and great matchups. He even went yard again tonight as we record on Monday night. He's a really good hitter that people sleep on. And, yeah, sure, he gets hurt a lot, but like you said, then you just drop him again. What's the big deal?
Yeah, I just tweeted about him yesterday, and on Yahoo, he was 9% owned.
Oh, so that's who you tweeted about when I asked who you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. No. A couple names. Elvis Andrus finally becoming the guy most thought he could be. Travis Shaw making all Boston fans regret life. And last but not least, when I was looking at Fantasy Pros April 2nd page on their rankings, so opening day rankings, Jose Ramirez was going 118 overall.
Yeah,
that's outstanding. Unbelievable. Dude,
that's my boy.
That pudgy little bastard.
Oh, he is so lovable, man. He's got that big ass and big lips, and like he's just kind of always ready to kiss somebody. He's always smiling. Yeah. He's having a blast. He's a great follow on Twitter too. He's so much fun. How do you not love him? So I'm so glad that he is an awesome player. Man, back in 2014, I was already pumping him up just based on his contact rates and everything, and just the fact that he was so young. And honestly, I didn't see him being this good, but I'm so stoked that he has.
Yeah, he's what baseball's supposed to be about, just out there having fun. And I'm really glad he pulled it off this year because everyone was writing off last season going, oh, it's a fluke, and he's done nothing but prove them wrong. It's been awesome.
Yep.
Let's go to Aria has a list. A list of people she wants to murder. And she's slowly doing that, like we talked about with the phrase recently. As a fantasy owner, if you played long enough any sport, you have a list of people that basically you would like to kill off and never own again. But more importantly, just from this season alone, what are some of the names that would be on your list that have just ruined some teams for you?
Yeah, there's been a few. Thankfully, my personal kryptonite Clay Buchholz hasn't been a factor this year, so I haven't been tempted to add him anywhere. God, I hate him. But Justin Verlander, I really thought that he was going to be at least on par with what he was going or what he did last year, pretty close to what he did last year, and he seems to have just sort of hit that point. I think he's like 34 years old now. I think his stuff is just diminished, and we're not going to see the same Verlander that we used to. And then Gerrit Cole, I actually don't own a ton of these other guys that I picked. Basically it's been injuries as far as most of the guys that have underperformed on my team, aside from, I guess maybe Jonathan VR is the only guy who I actually drafted who's really killed me. That's stunning to me what has happened to him. One of his calling cards has been his improving plate approach year over year. If you look at his contact, his swing rates and everything, he has consistently improved. And this year he just completely blew all of those gains out of the water. He just decided to start hacking at everything. He totally changed the player that he was. And now we've seen him just fall off the face of the earth. He's still stealing bases, but he's hitting around the Mendoza line. He's not walking like he used to. So he has killed me in my NL only league. And then some other guys, like I said, I don't really own these guys, but Gerrit Cole, I don't think that he's quite the guy that he was supposed to be. I don't know if he ever will be. I just don't think he's that good. I think you're looking at maybe like a number two pitcher in a good year. Maybe he's more like a number three with the strikeout rates that he's putting up. Manny Machado, he'll bounce back, but he's definitely killed you if you've owned him this far. Yeah, that batting average is just ridiculous, but he'll be okay. Don't worry. And then Miguel Cabrera, I think more of the same with him. Really weird first half, but I think he's one of the leaders in the expected weighted on base category. So I think he'll bounce back pretty nicely. And then Trevor Story, boy, the people that were singing his praises last year are crying in their soup so far this year. And he's gone far too extreme with the fly balls. And that has just cratered his BABIP. I don't care if you hit a Coors Field, when you hit everything in the air, a lot of those balls are getting caught, man. And his value has taken a hit unexpectedly just because of everybody else hitting for so much power too. You know, like I said, with the Justin Smokes of the world and everything, all of a sudden Logan Morrison is good and everything. So that sort of negates Story's value. Like, he doesn't have that homer upside at shortstop anymore that puts him head and tails over everybody else. So those guys, you know, Story, I don't know if he's necessarily going to rebound this year. I think I'm probably off him for the rest of this year. Maybe he can make an adjustment and get back to hitting more line drives instead of trying to hit every single thing in the air and over the fence in the future. But for this year, I'm off of him. But I would expect rebounds, like I said, for Miggy Machado.
Yeah. When we talked, you came on preseason to talk fantasy baseball. And I know you waxed poetically on yours as well. We were both very big on Johnny VR. That's just, like you said, it's kind of baffling how that's all come together. Then his return from the DL, he looked like he was finding it again, and then he fell off the map again. So it's curious to see how that comes together. Trevor Story was another one I had on my list on my baseball podcast. That was my dark horse to win the home run title. So if that's not happening, not happening at all. Cargo has been horrific. It might be retirement time for Cargo. Like, I'm all on board the Machado and Miggy buy low train. Cargo, I want nothing to do with. Like, he's got grayscale. Stay away.
Yeah, don't touch him.
Yeah, stay far, far away. Gregory Polanco has been massively disappointing. I keep thinking his year to break out. He's at that age and everything. And this year was horrific with him so far. I don't think it's going to get too much better. And then just a personal one, because he did affect my team, because he's a freaking moron and decides to ride dirt bikes in the middle of the season. Madison Bumgarner, when you take a picture that early, it's one thing to get an injury. It's another thing to get an injury like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good call on Polanco too, because I was in on him too. And, you know, he was another one like VR, like you had seen consistent year-over-year progression with him, especially in like hard contact and everything. And I thought this might have been the breakout year. And I seriously think that he's got to hit an injury or something just isn't right. Like, his hard contact is just completely tanked, and it looks sort of inexplicable because his batted ball profile is really the same. So I don't know. I don't think that I would be buying him for the second half, but Dynasty, I'm still in on him. I think it's just going to be sort of a lost year for him.
All right. So we mentioned a couple buy low targets. Let's move on to our final topic. George R.R. Martin, the masterful mind / psychotic, creepy mind for this whole thing. He has no problem killing anybody. Anybody. You kind of beat around the bush. What are a couple players you will never, ever own again due to their start?
Gregory Polanco did make my list there. And I think Kevin Gausman, boy, has he been bad. I've been pumping the Gauss for years and years. I somehow didn't own him this year. I don't know how, because I still liked him, but I think that now I'm not going to be in on him until he's with a different organization. I don't know what it is about Orioles and pitching, but they just can't do it. And then Kyle Hendricks, I didn't buy him after last year. You saw that historic Cubs defense, you know, all their pitchers had obscenely low BABIPs, and you knew that was going to come back. But Hendricks, when he came back down to earth from all that BABIP luck, and he doesn't strike out a ton of guys, I am not sold on him rebounding to any extent. And then Rick Porcello, I just have always hated Rick Porcello. For some reason, I traded for him because some of his peripherals looked really good after like a first month of the season. You know, he's striking out more guys than ever. His walk rate was good, and he was just, his hard hit rate was high. I'm like, well, that'll regress. And it sort of has in recent weeks. He's been better, but I've definitely endured a lot of crap with him that I didn't really expect.
Yeah, I agree, especially with the Gausman call. I was all aboard. Yep, he's finally going to do it. And then, nope, he finally did not. I mentioned kind of earlier, Cargo, never touching again. Story, I'm not, because by the time he figures it out, Brendan Rodgers will have taken his spot. So there's really no need to touch him, in my opinion. But the one that I used to never, ever take, and I took the gamble this year, and I never will again, ever. I don't care how well he pitches the rest of the year, the rest of his career. Masahiro Tanaka, dead to me.
Yeah.
Bonsai, be gone. I want nothing to do with that, man. I finally bought in thinking, okay, I always stayed away. The injury thing always scared me. But he you look at his numbers, and he does it year in and year out, even with the injury. No, not this year. They showed he's like a vampire now. Daytime, he's outstanding. Nighttime, he just gets destroyed. It's crazy what he's doing right now.
Really? Yeah, it's
– yeah, I mean,
with
someone tweeted it out. Yeah, he's like a 14 ERA at night.
Jeez. Yeah, I have not invested in him. I've just missed out on his good years. Just, you know, because the UCL seemed like a ticking time bomb in the elbow. And so nobody really wants to invest in that. And basically everybody for the last couple of years has got a huge return on their investment, because not only has he made it through the season, he's been excellent. But this year, yeah, that has totally fallen apart. So, yeah, I'm definitely with you on the Tanaka. Until he either retires or has Tommy John, I don't know if I'm going to be looking at him.
Yeah, I'll put that caveat in. If he has Tommy John, which is unlikely at his age and after waiting this long, then I would on the train. But until then, not happening. Not at all. Yeah.
I do have some buy lows and sell highs.
Oh, let's get at them. Okay. Yeah, the Khaleesi. I'll do the cheesy part. Khaleesi, as we saw at the end of Season 6, she's making deals. She wants to make herself a stronger army, a stronger force. Like we do in fantasy baseball, we make deals to improve our team. What are some buy lows and sell highs for the rest of the season?
Could I totally derail us for just a second?
Of course.
And go back to Game of Thrones?
Yes.
What's your favorite nudity that you've seen on the show so far?
Oh, dude. Okay, first off, I said it on my preview episode. She finally got naked again last season. Thank God she was such a stuck-up prude. When she was getting it from Khal Drogo, oh, my God, that was awesome. But favorite scenes, you know, some of those early ones when Tyrion was always at the whorehouse were very entertaining. Always, because he had, like, multiples in there.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. That's really good. What's yours?
Well, I definitely a shout out to Roz the Whore, who met her untimely demise thanks to a Joffrey arrow. She was always good. Like she was naked for almost the entire time that she was ever on the screen. So RIP Roz the Whore, gone too soon. But yeah, no, that's what reminded me of this question, is that it's definitely Emilia Clarke as Khaleesi. Way back in season one, like when she's getting in the tub and all that kind of stuff. That's yes. My favorite nudity of the whole season. What about Marjorie and
real quick, I forgot about that scene when she gets in the tub and she's talking to her brother, I think. That's yeah, creepy but really, really good. And I thought we'd never see it again because she basically came out in all kinds of interviews like, no, I'm not gonna do that. I'm a strong woman, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And boom. Light the place on fire, she gets naked again. Apparently we know what turns her on.
Stoke that fire.
Sorry, continue.
Okay. No, that's a I suppose I could go on back to the actual baseball now.
Well, no. I'm all about Game of Thrones. Marjorie, did she ever get naked?
She sure did. I forgot who it was even for. I can picture the scene especially well, but I don't remember who was looking at her.
Because I like – that was like the one person I was so depressed died in Cersei's mayhem.
She got
– I loved her character.
Yep.
I loved her character. She was very attractive. And just her character's mind, I thought she could have done a lot of damage in this next season.
Yep. She knew how to play the game, and she was slow playing it really well. But, you know, she caught up in something a little bit out of her hands, and she got screwed. She got a raw deal.
Yep, big time. What about the Cersei's fake walk of shame that wasn't really her?
Oh, man, I didn't find out about that until after the season was over. that upset me. But I guess that is an obscene amount of nudity to have to ask for from any actor. So that one in particular, I don't have a huge problem with the actress bowing out of that one. And she's actually, I don't think it was because she doesn't want to get naked, because she's been naked in movies before. So yeah. I think it was just the gratuitous aspect of it that she backed out of.
I don't blame her either. You said walking that far, getting stuff thrown at you and everything. I think I could pass on that.
Yeah.
All right, buy low, sell high.
Oh, back to baseball. You know, I put Johnny Cueto on this list as my buy low. I've got three buy lows and I think three sell highs prepared for you. Johnny Cueto is an even lower buy now than he once was because he's now on the disabled list with some stupid blisters. And that's a whole nother conversation. All these pitches dealing with blisters. Hypothesizing that it's because of the seams that are different. That's a different baseball and all that kind of stuff. Seems more than a coincidence to me. I'm one to kind of buy into that, but that's a whole nother conversation. I think Cueto can be a lot better in the second half. I wrote him up on Big Eye Fantasy Sports this past week as a guy who should rebound pretty nicely in the second half, assuming that he doesn't struggle with blisters too much. He's not going to be a Rich Hill. And then another guy, this guy could have qualified as a disappointment as well, because I did have stock in Carlos Rodon, and he's finally back. And he's been hit or miss so far. I think he walked six guys his first outing back. So that's not encouraging, but he's shown flashes of who he was in the past. And you look at his numbers last year, like he's chucking that change up. He's got confidence in it now. So that's going to avoid platoon splits that did him in for the first year around the league. His walk rate was like cut in half from the year before. And so I do think that once he knocks all the rust off, those walks will be much more under control. So I like Carlos Rodon a lot over the course of the second half, and you're going to always get a strikeout per inning with him. And then my third buy low guy is AJ Pollock, another guy who's been injured. He missed most of the first half of the season. And this dude does have, I will say, he's got a propensity to get injured for sure. So there is an injury risk with him. But with the state of stolen bases right now, he can be a true difference maker in the second half. And he can also score. I mean, we've seen it before. He can hit for a really great average. He can score you a ton of runs. So he could be like the Starling Marte that everybody's been hanging on for, who's been suspended for the first half. You do have to worry about injuries, like I said, but if you're going to buy, if you're desperate, you're buying him, you're basically the stolen base upside that you're hoping for from like maybe a Trey Turner or something like that, that you're obviously not going to get.
Yeah. I love all those. I'm a big Pollock guy. He has in that lineup leading off that ballpark, tons to love there. You mentioned Machado and Cabrera earlier. That's an obvious one. The Cueto thing I wanted to mention to you, I don't know why they waited till now, if it's because Bumgarner's back now or whatever. He's been battling two blisters on different fingers since like May.
That explains a lot of it.
Yeah, that's what I kept telling guys. I'm like, I know he's not looking good and his strikeouts are down, but let's just take it with a grain of salt. I don't know why they waited so long when the season's already over. What are you doing? You know, you need to try to trade him and whatever. The Giants this year, I don't know. But, yeah, he's been battling blisters for a while. The other guy that I had as an interesting one, it's a gamble, but I think the upside's there, and he's really played well or okay or better, however you want to decide on it the last few weeks, is Odubel Herrera. You can get them super cheap. Like these other names are like still big name guys, so you still might have to pay a little bit for them. You can get Odubel ridiculously cheap right now because everyone's given up on him. But if people look at the way he's been playing the last, you know, at the most a month, he's actually played really, really well, a lot more like the Odubel of old. He's just a guy to keep an eye on if you want a little upside without giving up too much.
Yeah, he can be had for next to nothing for sure. I'm worried about him overall. I don't know what happened to his steals, man. He's 5-for-10 so far this year. That aspect of his game has just completely fallen off. But yeah. I, as a complete cheap buy, yeah, I'm in on him.
And what are your sells?
My sells, well, we'll see if we can get some disagreement out of you here. I don't know. Might ruffle some feathers. I don't have any Giants on this list, though, so I'm safe. Will Myers, actually. I have him as a sell high. Dude has completely changed his approach from last year. His strikeout rate is up 7% to 30%. this year. Contact rates down 7% as well, 73%. He's got a 252 batting average, and that's living off a 330 BABIP. And that is not sustainable with all those strikeouts and a 17% pop-up rate too. So I see that profile falling substantially over the course of the second half. Steals, they're well off his pace as well. 28 steals from last year. He's not going to approach that this year either. So I've been trying. I've got him in the Nasty Cast Podcast League. I've been trying to sell him all year, and I haven't found any takers yet. Maybe I've been barking up the wrong trees, but I would be selling Will Myers if I can. And then another first baseman, Mark Reynolds, out in Colorado. He's been a first half MVP for a lot of guys. Somebody I didn't even consider coming into the season because, you know, you had Ian Desmond that was supposed to be a first base every day. Literally never thought about Mark Reynolds. But 29% strikeout rate, 27.5% home run per fly ball rate, and that's off of just 32% hard contact rate. So that will go down. 66% contact rate too. That's just scary. That's really, really low. He's also played his highest games. He's trending towards that this year, but since 2011, the highest games played that he's had is 140. So he's older than ever, obviously, and he's close to a lock, I think, to find the disabled list over the course of the second half. So he's a definite sell for me. And if he falls off at all too, they've got Ryan McMahon, who's just tearing the cover off the ball in the minor leagues. So there's a chance that he comes up too. And then my third guy is Brett Gardner out in New York. He's been a godsend for me. I've somehow got him in multiple leagues just randomly. It's not like I was in on him. This has just been batshit luck in the good form for me. I always complain about the bad luck. So when something like this comes along, it makes me really happy. Of course, now I'm trying to sell high on him like I'm recommending right now. I'm not finding any suitors because perhaps everybody else agrees like me. I mean, he's a career first half guy. Yep. I will say so far this year, hard contact rate is up. That's it seems like it's sustainable power, right? It's up to 34%. Fly ball percentage is way up. Pull percentage is way up. But like I said, career first half guy, his OPS split for his career, 774 OPS in the first half, 683 in the second half, almost 100 points lower. He's almost 34. So his likelihood of missing time with injury, you know, along with Mark Reynolds and really Will Myers too. These guys all have had pretty extensive injury histories. I think his chance of finding the disabled list is pretty high over the course of the second half too. So I'd be selling Brett Gardner if I could.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Will Myers, he's a guy that's really surprised me this year because I thought he'd take the next step, and he started out like he was going to, and he's kind of, to me, just kind of plateauing at the moment. It's really weird watching him play. What are your thoughts on the Judge and Bellinger conundrum? Because, you know, Thames came out the door early in the season, and everyone said, oh, did we keep him, sell him? Well, the ones that said sell him are looking beautiful right now. Obviously, regression has to come into play. What do you think on Bellinger and Judge?
Judge, I'm really not worried about at all. He just strikes me as an otherworldly talent. I think he's going to be a dynasty monster, a behemoth for years and years to come. He hits the ball so hard. He's got such effortless power that he's going to sustain really high BABIPs throughout his career. A lot of balls that wouldn't leave the yard for anybody else on planet Earth are going to fly out with him. So I'm really not worried about him too much. Bellinger is a little bit of a different story. We've seen him go through prolonged slumps already, and he's got a completely different swing from Aaron Judge that has a lot more holes in it, and he's just completely all or nothing, you know. So I don't think he's going to be able to sustain the type of batting average that an Aaron Judge can. I think he's going to strike out a lot. So if I'm selling either one of them, I don't think I am, but if I was, I would sell on Bellinger and think that pitchers are going to adjust to him a little bit over the second half. But, you know, it all depends on sort of what your return is, right? Because when you were selling Eric Thames, it was like, oh, God, I'm getting, like, you know, Max Scherzer for him earlier on the season. You know, like, if you get a no-brainer like that, then sure, go ahead. But for the most part, I'm not necessarily looking to sell those guys.
Okay. A couple that could be controversial, maybe I'll get you riled up here, that I would look into, and you mentioned his name earlier as an overachiever maybe, or is doing really well. Overachiever's rude. But Alex Wood, I would deal him now. He's got an injury history in his past. He's already, you know, you never know if he's going to go five or six innings or more. He's been productive, but how long is that – he could be great. This could be wrong. But at the same time, if you have an Alex Wood and you need multiple players, you could really reload your squad with an Alex Wood type who is just overachieving like crazy in my mind. Not saying he'll be bad the rest of the way, but I don't know if he can ever keep this kind of pace up.
Yeah, well, it is the injury. If you are worried about injury with him, that's definitely something that he's proven so far, is that he is going to find the disabled list pretty consistently. But what he's been doing so far, I think, is pretty well deserved.
Yeah. Another guy, and he's already kind of starting to slump and show these true faces. He's super talented, especially at home. But as people know in baseball, you play half your games on the road. Jake Lamb, get what you can. That's what I would say, because that average continues to fall. Power is there, but only really at home. So I'd say get what you can with that one, because he's had a great year. And the other one I'd look at is Starlin Castro for the Yankees.
Definitely, yeah.
The only downside of short is shortstop's so just dead and empty. You'd have to at least get like a half-decent one in return in your deal, or pray someone's on the waiver wire, like a Freddie Galvis or something, just to like hold the spot. Which isn't a bad hold, but I would get rid of Castro as quickly as you can.
Yeah, especially if you're getting a really nice player in return. But yeah, for him, it's just all BABIP. It's nothing that he's done is any different than what he's done in the past. It's just his batting average is higher than it should be. But I will say that the Yankees lineup has been a lot better than I thought it was going to be coming into the year. So the runs in RBI are better than what I would have forecast, but. Yeah, running back to Jake Lamb too. He was a guy who I would say the most pessimistic on the show when we brought him up. I mean, it was probably a good month ago now, but I mean, the guy still isn't hitting lefties worth a lick. I will say that, like, as far as just power hitters that bash righties, he's up there, I think, in all of the major leagues right now. But he has been overachieving in the first half, so I think he can still be really good. But yeah, he's not necessarily a complete player yet. He's still got a ways to go.
Yeah, I think people have such a high expectation. And I love Jake Lamb. I really do. He's super talented. He's a great DFS play. But season long, you could probably get a pretty nice haul from the right owner looking for an upgrade there. One last thing I want to ask you. It's not on the outline. It's not even really Game of Thrones related. But I know we talked preseason and you were kind of like, eh, I don't know. How's life being a Minnesota Twins fan this year?
Boy, talk about a stark contrast from a year ago.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's good to revisit that, because we did talk a substantial amount of Twins. And I mean, I would say it was something I brought up at the beginning, you know, before the season, I guess, the effect that Jason Castro behind the dish could have on that Twins pitching staff, man. I think we've seen it quite a bit with Santana, with Barrios, you know, the turnaround that those guys have had from a year ago. It's night and day, and that's been the Twins right there. That and, you know, Buxton, I don't know if you ended up drafting him in a lot of leagues this year. I think I was kind of trying to talk you down from him a little bit, because I wasn't quite seeing the breakout, and now I'm just hoping that it comes. But, man, that dude can fly, and his defense is outstanding. And I was watching their game against Houston just last night. I think it was last night or two nights ago. In any case, they had Eddie Rosario freaking playing center field, and just – he gave up like two runs on a catch that Buxton would have made with ease. And so right there alone, like, you could see, even if he's hitting around the Mendoza line, you know, like the difference that Buxton makes in his base running and his defense, that's going to keep him in the lineup for a career. So hopefully the hitting comes around. So as a Twins fan, I get to enjoy him just for the player that he is, but I want to be able to suck in like 50 steals a year in fantasy too. And so I still got aspirations for him, man.
Yeah, no, I got lucky. I didn't get him everywhere I wanted because people were buying him way higher than I wanted to go. I love his talent. I'm with you there. He's so fun to watch, and I'm hoping someday he figures it out. He's shown signs of life, I would say, the last, what, month maybe? He's looked a lot better. Yeah. But he still has a ways to go, obviously.
Well, they're not doing him any favors either with the coaching staff and his hitting coach. Like, 1 week he'll have a leg kick, and the next week it's gone, and then 3 weeks later they'll bring it back. It's like, quit screwing around with the guy. How are you supposed to, you know, if you don't have any consistency whatsoever, how are you supposed to be successful at the major league freaking level? Like, the minor leagues is when you're supposed to be toying around with stuff like that, and they're still yanking him back and forth. So it's no wonder that he's failed so far this year at the plate.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Can they hang on to at least get to the postseason? I won't say win the Central. You can say it if you want. Do they make the postseason?
I don't think so. If you look at their run differential, it's really bad. It's like negative 50 or something like that. They should be well under 500 if you just go by that and sort of average it out. And we've already seen Irvin Santana come back to earth. I think he's going to continue to be more of a mid to back end type of starter as opposed to the elite ace that he somehow decided to be over the course of the first half. And their bullpen is just atrocious too. So I will say that if they wanted to make a run, which I'm personally still kind of on the fence, I don't know whether they should buy or sell. But I think just because there's so much regression coming and that bullpen is just so terrible that they're better off selling and just hopefully getting a mint for Irvin Santana. So it sort of pains me to say it because you definitely didn't expect him to be here. I think there's a lot of second half regression coming and they're going to go downhill. So hopefully it hits them fast. And like I said, they can unload Santana and get a mint in return.
Yeah, I would seriously look into becoming sellers and realizing you guys are about a year ahead of schedule. I think you're having a great year, but you have a little more developing to do, and then it'll really come together. Because what Sano's been able to put together has been outstanding. Kepler and company, it's fun to watch. Definitely is fun to watch.
Absolutely. I have, for the most part, enjoyed watching the Twins this year, especially when Joe Mauer's been on the disabled list.
How does he keep batting him like third? Ruins the lineup.
Well, okay, Paul Molitor needs to go. I will say that he is he's not the greatest manager, not the worst either, but especially in his bullpen uses, he's just not good. But yeah, lineup construction leaves a little bit to be desired. You're sort of trying to make lemonade out of lemons as far as with what you have with Joe Mauer. He's basically a platoon first base DH type that's owed $23 million a year for the next year and a half. So there's only so much you can do with that. But I wanted to say one thing, too, as long as we're on this topic. Baseball Prospectus is doing an event at Target Field August 5th, and I'm going to be there. You get a meet and greet with like the GM of the Twins and a bunch of like Aaron Gleeman, the editor of Baseball Prospectus, a bunch of other writers and stuff. So I'm going to be there. So if anybody's out there listening to this right now and they're going to be at that, I'd love to meet up, get a hot dog or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm hoping they do one in San Francisco one day because I saw they did that one in Baltimore recently. It looked like a lot of fun, a lot of good stuff there. That's pretty awesome. I know you get to meet the GM and everything. That's a good time.
Yeah, you get apparently it's like most of the brass. I'm in a fantasy league with Dustin Morse, who's like the – I don't exactly know what his role is, but he's up in the front office with the Twins. So I'm stoked to meet him and give him some crap over this Joey Votto trade that we made last year. So it should be fun, but yeah, I'm looking at talking baseball with a lot of other dorks like us.
Awesome. That's awesome. That sounds like a blast. All right. Well, I could sit and talk Game of Thrones and baseball with you all day, but I think someone might get mad at us like our wives. Yeah. Any last words, my friend? Did you want to plug all your stuff one more time?
No, it's too much. I'll run out of breath.
Go check out the Nasty Cast on all forums. Go check out Fantrax Radio, and he's at Nathan Dawkin. Check that out.
Yeah, I pretty much link to everything from Twitter. So if you follow me on Twitter, then you'll get all that good stuff. You'll be able to find the work.
And if you guys check out the podcast that we are doing now, I put all his @s that he works for or writes for on the info on the podcast. So they're all right there.
That's a long list.
It was. It actually took up like a line and a half. It was pretty impressive.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, man. It's been a blast. We'll have to do it again very soon.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. It's always great having you, man. I appreciate it. We'll have one last outro before we wrap it up. But everybody, thanks for listening. Check me out on Twitter @BDNTrick. Again, Nathan, awesome time. This was Bench with Bubba, episode 46, Game of Thrones meets fantasy baseball, more Game of Thrones. We'll catch you guys later.
Shall we begin?
Yes. Yes, we shall.
Life's better with an auto policy from American Family Insurance. No matter what dreams you're driving towards. That's because our expert agents will make you feel totally protected with the right auto coverage at the right price. You'll also save up to 23% when you bundle auto with home. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.